Well, as the saying goes, they save the best till last, right? No. Before I begin, I want to do one thing. I was not able to be here, I guess, the other night, the IOBC meeting when they honored Jack DeLoach. And Jack, I personally would like to say thank you. The honor is well deserved. You've been a shining light in the field of biocontrol for a lot of years and had, a key role in my involvement in weed biocontrol. And again, I want to say thanks.
Jim, I'd like to thank you for a few years of really good work you did with us.
That was the last time I did really good work, I guess. Anyway, let me go. Thank you. Let me begin here by sort of looking at some things that maybe, you know, a lot of us have thought about over the years, but how can we do releases to get a real idea of what biocontrol agents are going to do, where they're going to be introduced, but can we really do that? And the bottom line is, no, in most cases we cannot do that. Usually there's some issues regarding obviously the safety of the organism, but there may be some tools that we can use to maybe get around this to get us a real clear picture of what these organisms might do in the area of introduction, but do it on a temporary basis. And I want to acknowledge, of course, a lot of folks, in particular Honor Mori, one of my graduate students who is going to figure prominently in this talk, and also Veronica Manrique, who contributed some data for this talk as well. So the outline for the talk is basically for some of the folks that are not all that familiar with weed biocontrol, but I see most of you are, go through very quickly, some review the risk assessment process, and then describe these innovative approaches that I've been looking at least considering, and then illustrate these with a couple of Brazilian pepper tree case studies with a defoliating soft lime and a leaf rolling moth, and then hopefully entertain a few questions and comments. Well, as a good biocontrol teacher and extension person, we give a lot of talks and we go out in the field and give people an idea of, you know, what's the benefits of weed biocontrol. And we always say they're environmentally friendly because it's minimal impacts on non-targets. It's suitable for weeds affecting agricultural or natural ecosystems because of minimal disturbance, which is conducive to agent establishment. And also that classical biocontrol is permanent. There's a high degree of sustainability to it. But there's also a bit of a downside. It's that very last thing. It's because of the permanency, there's a high risk involved, irreversibility of biocontrol introductions. And I think we all recognize this, and we all strive to do the very best we can to make sure these releases are going to do what they're supposed to do and not have any non-target impacts. Regarding this risk assessment process, those of us in the weed biocontrol community, we all know this, it's pretty straightforward. You have to do this because it's required to satisfy the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969. And again, this is from looking from APHIS perspective, because they're the ones that issue these release permits. And basically what we have to show is that the damage by the introduced natural enemies to our flora, and if you look at the wording, and fauna within the intended release area should be minimal. So then the outcome of, once you do these environmental and biological assessments, the outcome must result in the finding of no significant impact, or a FONSI, as they use the acronym. This whole idea of significant is kind of interesting, because I think what I see, and maybe most of us see now, is no impact. It's almost like a zero tolerance for any sort of non-target issue. The information that we use is basically documented in this TAG reviewer's manual. It's a good guideline for those of you who are in weed biocontrol or interested in weed biocontrol. Basically tells you basically how to prepare your petitions, what kind of information to include. I think John Goolsbee did a nice job today outlining some of that, particularly this impact studies that are now becoming more and more critical in addition to the specificity data. And again, this is basically the procedure. You develop a test plant list, and you get hopefully approval from the technical advisory group. They make some comments on it. And once you get that finalized, then you are back, once you have your organism in quarantine, you conduct your host specificity tests, either conducted with all the life stages, larvae, adults, or both. And the purpose then is to define what's called the absolute or fundamental host range and sort of get a handle on that, and then sort of from that predict or kind of estimate what this field host specificity is going to be if this agent were approved for release. And again, this is essential for, again, to assess the potential risk to non-target plants. But again, because of the way the National Environmental Policy Act is issued, there's no way to look at any effects on the animals. So this is not part of your testing process, doesn't include animals. The candidate biocontrol agents then, obviously, and this is where we've been going recently in the last maybe about 10 years or so, subjected to these open field tests in a native range. And these are probably the best thing you can do because now you can allow the insect to select and search for the test plant in its natural setting without any sort of confining constraints of laboratory and sort of these obstacles that the insects often have to overcome in a laboratory setting. Again, it allows the insect to exhibit really natural behavior. Now, the only issue is, and I think I tried to get this out a little bit out of John this morning, is that the plants that they test, let's say, in South America aren't the same test plants we're interested in North America. And they would not allow us to bring a lot of our plants down to Brazil to test in the field, and rightly so. Some of these things could come and become invasive in other countries, and other countries are concerned about that sort of thing. So there's a little bit of a dilemma here. It'd be kind of nice to be able to test our plants in an open field setting. Is that possible? Well, I'm going to get to that. If you look at the permitting process, and this is outlined in the TAG manual, the key thing here is this box where, you know, APHIS determines if release will result in the finding of no significant impact or a FONSI, and if that's conclude that's the case, then they will issue a release permit to the petitioner. And until recently, notice this is 2005. In the recent versions of this, they've taken out the with or without mitigation measures, which I thought was kind of interesting because when you prepare your TAG petition, at the very end, you have to outline what sort of mitigation measures you're going to provide when you make your releases. So, at that point, hopefully that'll set the stage. Well, let's look at some of these innovative approaches that I think could be used, and if people would maybe take a harder look at this, and then the bottom line is to convince the regulatory community that these are legitimate procedures that would help us get the best information we can possibly get. One of them is Arenatoki, which is a biological approach. And it's basically a haplodiploidy. I think Bill referred to this earlier today in one of his talks. And what it is that, you know, mated adults, the progeny from mated or unmated adults can occur. And the females will produce female and male progeny if they're mated, but if they're not mated, you'll get only unfertilized, but the unfertilized eggs will produce haploid male offspring. So in other words, what you could do, you could put mated females or unmated females out into the field. These will actually seek out, let's say, plants. You'll get larval development, damage, and so on, but that's where it ends because all you'll wind up with are male adults, so you cannot have an established population. And again, this process occurs in all major orders of arthropods used for biocontrol of weeds except the Lepidoptera, but there's another way of dealing with that. These are the taxa that have been used in weed biocontrol from Coleoptera down to Acarina, and these are the successes and versus and also the number of species and a percentage. And you can see that if you look at the Arenatoki, the phenomenon, whether it occurs, you can see it occurs in every one of these major orders that have been used in weed biocontrol except for the Lepidoptera. So again, if you have an agent that exhibits Arenatoki, this may be something you want could look at as a possibility, again, if we can convince the regulatory community this is a viable approach. The other approach is a physical approach. It's called the F1 sterile insect technique. And then this is suitable for Lepidoptera. And this approach was proposed by Pat Greeney and Jim Carpenter, I think early as 2000, as a way of maybe looking at field temporary releases of weed biocontrol agents to see what they might do. And if there's a problem, you could stop it, and then that would be the end of it. The partially sterile males mate with untreated females, and then complete sterility is manifested in the F1 generation. What happens is that you get decreased egg hatch, and the F1 offspring are pretty much highly sterile and predominantly male. And it's a relatively simple process. This procedure for sterile insect techniques has been in the entomology arena for many years. This is sort of a little bit of a different take on it. You basically irradiate your insects, and you take then a partially sterile male, cross it with a fertile female, and what happens in the F1 offspring, you get sterile males. So again, no opportunity for getting a persistent population because the females are taken out of the picture. So let's kind of illustrate these with some Brazilian pepper tree case studies. And I'll talk about one of the insects we were excited about very early on when I came onto the project was a defoliating sawfly. Brazilian pepper tree, I won't go through all of it, but basically you can see its distribution, major problem here in Florida, South Texas, Southern California, Hawaii, and so on. You can see it's very attractive, was brought into Florida as an ornamental and so on. Bill hit that pretty well. Again, growth habit, very different in its native range compared to Florida. We are now all, I might add though, we're seeing some expansion of the range up here, even up in Nassau County and even up in, I think now, southern Georgia. So this could be something to do with either it's adapting to colder climates or this is an effect of climate change. So why was this plant targeted for biocontrol? Well, it's certainly non-native and invasive, causes severe ecological damage. It's a member of the poison ivy family, so it's toxic and allergenic. Really very low beneficial value, except for beekeepers that sort of like it because it's one of the only plants that blooms in Florida during the fall. But I think I've convinced our beekeepers that they need to be looking at something else. Conventional controls are very temporary and costly. I think the most important reason, though, there are no native congeners of the genus Shinus in the U.S. And Shepard et al. Referred to this as sort of a self-mitigation of risk. So in other words, you can minimize the spillover effect if you don't have many close relatives or no close relatives in the system. Well, here's the insect. It was a defoliating sawfly, Heteropria hubricki malaise. Female here, they basically split the stem, oviposit eggs here, and they stay with the larvae, or the eggs, until the larvae hatch. Larvae very gregarious and extremely damaging. Here's the pupa stage, and pupa's in the ground. This is a plant, a couple of plants we actually looked at in Brazil. And then, again, because I came on relatively later after this insect was involved, my first question was, is a defoliator going to be really effective for weed bile control of Brazilian pepper trees? So we went back and looked at some simulated herbivory studies in Fort Pierce, and pretty much we showed that. Here's the control in red. If you defoliate the plant just a single time, it actually grows bigger. It actually is more aggressive. But if you get sustained defoliation over a period of time, the plant pretty much is pretty wimpy, and you can reduce the aggressiveness of the plant and make it less competitive. The downside, though, when we were looking, really kind of excited, was that there were some toxins discovered in sawflies in the family Pergidae, and this came out of some work that was, I think, Ted and his group with Melaleuca. They had a Lophurtoma sawfly they were concerned about because there were some Lophurtoma sawflies in Australia that were on Melaleuca, not the one for the Melaleuca biocontrol, but there were some other ones that were known to contain some pretty potent toxins. And they basically can cause severe liver and kidney necrosis, and you can see the susceptible vertebrates here. We did a analysis, and here's a spectrograph. You can see we did our sawfly, among other sawflies in his family, did contain these two toxins, Pergidon and Lophurtoma. So obviously there's cause for concern. We have now a potentially toxic insect. So my first response was, well, you know, we've got this insect. It was recommended for release by TAG. What can we do about this? We did a survey of the veterinarians in that area of Brazil. There were no reports of any cattle poisonings, but we decided to go ahead and try to do some cattle feeding trials. We actually force-fed up to 300 larvae to various groups of cattle, and you can see here from this graph, looking at the activity profile in the blood and liver chemistry, the green is the control when no larvae were ingested, and the red is the high amount of larvae, 300 larvae per individual animal. And you can see there really was no statistical difference, or really no difference at all between these different profiles, whether liver or blood, compared to the control. An interesting thing happened too. One of the cattle in the 300 larval group, and turns out, happened to be pregnant at the time, and she gave birth to what turned out to be a normal calf. So there was some concern or maybe some mutagenic or teratological effects, and that happened not to be the case, at least with this unreplicated event. APHIS was looking pretty good at this data, and they were sort of kind of now thinking, well, maybe you can go ahead and do that. Why don't you go ahead and test some birds? So we tested some red-winged blackbirds through APHIS laboratory in Gainesville, and basically what was gleaned from that, there was no harmful or lethal effects on red-winged blackbirds, whether they ingested small numbers or small larvae or large larvae. So basically from this, we finally determined that the cattle and this representative bird were unaffected by consumption of the larvae, and there were no reports of poisonings in Brazil. The host range and toxicity studies indicated that this sawfly probably would be safe to release in Florida. We even submitted the data to our state review committee. They unanimously approved it, which is the state arthropod and plant committee. But in the final analysis, APHIS did not want to take the risk and decided not to issue the release permit because there were concerns about what other migratory birds might be affected and so on. So again, I was thinking, what else could we have done? Well, again, Arenatoki is a fairly common phenomenon in Hymenoptera. You can see here, these are data that Veronica helped to collect. When you have mated females, male and females, got 124 eggs, you had a breakdown of 30 males and 21 female adults. When you had unmated females, they laid eggs, developed, only males came out. So again, we confirmed that the rennet turkey did occur in this particular insect. So we felt like this sawfly was an effective agent. It was host-specific, common, gregarious, and in, I guess, Lincoln Smith's terminology, was well-defended. He published a paper, I guess, in a symposium in 2003. The TAG did recommend release of this insect in 97, but they reversed their decision in 2007. Now, we felt like that we could prevent permanent establishment by pre-releasing only these unmated females. We confirmed the arena toki in a laboratory test. We think that we could demonstrate, by using this approach, demonstrate the safety of these larvae to any mammals or birds in this release area in an open field setting, and then videotape what was going on. And if there was an issue, a toxicity issue, we could actually go ahead and stop this release under the situation that we had. So we could do a pre-release of a biocontrol agent using this biological approach. The other approach we're talking about involved this, the physical approach with the leaf rolling moth, the F1SIT. Rodrigo talked a little bit about Epizomus earlier. This was Epizomus utilis that was released in Hawaii, and underwent a name change recently, showing you the life cycle. Males and females are dimorphic, which is a good thing. You can separate the sexes very easily, which is important for this sort of research. It's a leaf tire and can be quite damaging. It was introduced in Hawaii in 54. By the 57 establishment was confirmed, the mid-70s, they were getting pretty good populations in the field. But right after about that time, things sort of started to taper off, and we think, based on what we've read in some of the literature, they were getting spillover to this insect from generalist parasitoids and predators that were imported into Hawaii to control a variety of agricultural pests, among them the sugarcane leaf roller. So they were getting significant off-target parasitism by these insect biocontrol agents. In terms of our host specificity test, we conducted the initial no-choice test, and this sort of kind of blew me away initially. We were getting non-target damage development on plants in 6 genera of the Anacardiaceae. Here's Brazilian pepper tree here, Cotinus, pistachio, a couple of species of ruse, toxicodendron, and this is cashew here. But what was surprising to me is that we got no development at all on the most closely related species, Shinus molly, which, again, is kind of unusual in some of these tests. You do not get what you would normally expect to get under field conditions, where you get false positives and so on. However, when we did the multiple choice test in the laboratory, it pretty much made a clearer picture, much clearer. They clearly preferred Brazilian pepper tree over everything else. But again, we're still getting a little bit of attack. So could we even clarify this picture even more? And what we thought about was trying this approach. And what you had to do is develop the protocol for production of the F1 sterile insects through radiation biology studies for the parental phase, and then determine the level of radiation for F1 sterility, which is the F1 phase. One of the things that's required here, you gotta be able to produce a lot of insects. And this insect turned out to be one of the easiest to reproduce. You can see some of the colony production here. We get quite a few individuals. Very easy to rear on Brazilian pepper tree potted plants. But due to parental phase, we wanted to expose these things to different radiation levels, which we did, and then we mated them, put them in these overposition chambers, 5 males and 5 females. And then we incubated the egg sheets and also dissected the females to ensure that they actually mated. And then looking at the percent of egg hatch from these different treatments, we started at 50 grays and went all the way up to 300. At this point right here, you notice that you have 100% sterility right here at this point, 200 grays, when you have treated females crossed with either a non-treated male or a treated male. But if you look at the non-treated female crossed with a treated male right here, you did have some viability of the insects or the adults. So then we decided to focus on that level of radiation, and we even bumped it up a little bit. We started here at 200. We actually, for a safety factor, we used 225 grays. We radiated the moths here, exposed them to the unmated and untreated females, put them in the same chamber. Look at the F1 egg sheets, and then allow these insects to complete their development on potted plants, and then look at their fertility. This is showing some of the procedures here. What we did show here now, if you have an F1 female crossed with a non-treated male, you can see that percent egg hatch, you still get some egg hatch. But if you have an F1 female crossed, F1 male crossed with a non-treated female, basically what happens, you stop, you get any sort of reproduction at 225 grays. The other part of this is that if you did get reproduction, at these higher radiation doses, the male-female ratio was highly skewed in favor of males. So summary here is, percent egg hatch is significantly affected by the dose of radiation and gender. The females exhibit 100% sterility at 225 grays, and you get a preponderance of males at higher radiation doses, and this is, would be an added safety factor for pre-release field study in the proposed release area. So the benefits of this is that there's no risk of permanent establishment of the candidate biocontrol agent. The field release is temporary and reversible, particularly if you start seeing some of these non-target effects. It's a more reliable predictor of field host specificity than traditional lab tests, and in my view, would improve really this whole risk analysis process. If you have agents that are you think are good agents and maybe require some additional testing and give them the best chance to perform in the area where they might be introduced. And this also would satisfy these F1 SIT and also that Rinitoki would satisfy the tag requirements providing effective mitigation measures. I'll conclude with this slide is actually adapted from a paper by Bax et al. 2001 from Conservation Biology, and they identified certain steps for assessing biocontrol safety. One was to conduct pre-release studies on biocontrol agents. Well, that's a no-brainer. We do that. Host range testing on the target pest and non-target organisms. They assess the risk of the biocontrol, possible harm and mitigation measures. Well, this is done in the tag petition and also part of the environmental and biological assessment process. So we do that. Conduct benefit risk analysis. APHIS PPQ does this. I'm not sure exactly what the procedures are there, as again, it's probably part of that biological and assessment process. Then it says, and this is I think the critical one, use adaptive and reversible protocols to assess unforeseen risks. And again, there are some unforeseen risks with a lot of these biocontrol agents. Rinitoki or F1 SIT could satisfy the recommendation here if we're looking at some candidate insects that might require some additional testing. Based on those results, you can revise the benefit risk analysis and then conduct full-scale release of the biocontrol agent. And with that, I will conclude. And if there are any questions or comments, I'm glad to take them. I see no one's really happy about making pre-release studies, right, using these novel approaches. Okay, thank you.
There's one question.
I'm sorry.
What
yeah,
kind
Jeff.
Of cost are you looking at for getting them sterilized?
What kind of
cost?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think it was all that expensive. I think partly because we had access to a radiator and the people at DPI were there to work with us. Again, that's something that would have to be looked at. Again, it's probably going to be, there's going to be some expense involved. The biggest cost, I think, would be rearing the insects, and that required a lot of plant material, and again, but that's something you're doing anyway, and usually have OPS people deal with that. Bill?
Do you think you could get enough data if you could release your Rinitoccus salt flies to satisfy people that migratory birds wouldn't be at risk, you know, through video or whatever you plan to do?
I think there's a possibility. You could at least see initially if the birds were ingesting the sawfly larvae, if they were regurgitated immediately, which we did see with the red-winged blackbirds, you could look at a lot of different bird species that way and see if there's any risk. Now, again, some of them may ingest the bird or best of the larvae and then fly off. You might have an issue there. But I think you could pretty much get an idea. Again, you could look at a lot of different migratory bird species that way, though. And again, we had a guy down in, I think, Loxahatchee that was willing to do that because they were looking at some bird seed dispersal studies, and he was videotaping that, so he was willing to do that for us. It's not everything's, you know, it's not the complete answer, but again, it's one step that's a little further where you're actually able to do this in the actual area of introduction under the actual conditions the insect to be exposed to. Okay.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much to everybody to stay in until the end of the symposium, and thank you very much for the speaker. It was an excellent selection of talks. And if there's any other questions, maybe we can stay for a little bit, but it's getting a little late, so it's up to you. No more questions? Okay. Yes. A comment?
Any of us would entertain ideas for topics. It's kind of Florida-centric, and we really It's a big country, a lot of research all over the world. Thanks to you for coming from all the way from Australia. Let's not just make this a Florida operation. So I welcome your comments to future topics.
Thank you.
Thank you, organizers.